Hello and welcome to the New Books and Buddhist Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Scott Mitchell. Today we're going to be talking with Anne Blackburn, author of the new book, Locations of Buddhism, Colonialism, and Modernity in Sri Lanka. Professor Blackburn's book is primarily what she calls a micro-history of a particular monk who lived in Sri Lanka during British colonial rule from 1827 to 1911, Hikuduwe Sumangala. He inhabited many different fields, or what Professor Blackburn refers to as collectivities of belonging, where he engaged in a lot of Buddhist Christian debates, as well as lay monastic organizations, in order to help develop Buddhism or protect Buddhism during the British colonial period. Her book obviously touches on not only colonialism, but also the ongoing debates that Buddhist studies is having about Buddhist modernism or modernity. I think raises a lot of very important questions about how we study this particular period of Buddhist history. And has a lot of applicability not just to studies of South Asia or Sri Lanka, but also to other areas of the Buddhist world that have been marked by colonial rule or colonial engagement, or a bit later in history, of course, imperialism throughout, for example, East Asia. Her book, I think, raises lots of very important questions about how we go about studying this particular period of Buddhist history. I can highly recommend this book. I think it's very well written. And without further ado, let's get to the interview. Okay, so I want to say hello to Anne Blackburn. Hi, how are you today?
Hi, Scott. It's a pleasure to be with you on the phone. Thanks for calling.
Thanks so much for agreeing to the interview. Your book is, of course, Locations of Buddhism, Colonialism, and Modernity in Sri Lanka, which is a wonderful, great contribution to the not only to the field of South Asian Buddhism, but also to the ongoing debates about colonialism and modernity and post-colonial studies. And in a previous episode of the New Books in Buddhism show, we had a chance to speak with David McMahon, who, of course, has done a lot of work on Buddhist modernity, and so our listeners are probably aware of some of these issues. But of course, your book focuses on a very specific character, and we'll get to that. And I just want to say that I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
Well, thanks for those kind words, and I'm happy to speak with you today. And I also think that David's book is a great contribution, so I'm glad that you had him on as part of your podcast series.
Thanks. How we usually start things off, of course, is to find out a little bit about our guests. Could tell us and how you came to be interested in Buddhist studies, but as in general, but also in terms of the particular subject of your book.
Okay, thanks, Scott. I think really I would probably go back to undergraduate studies days when I ended up at Swarthmore College in really good professorial company. I took a number of classes in the history department with Professor Lillian Lee, and with her worked on, really sort of roughly speaking, I guess we could say medieval Chinese and Japanese history and early modern periods as well. One of the striking things about some of those readings was the mention that was made of the intersection between what we might call religion and what we might call politics, especially in relation to how imperial centers in East Asia engaged with Buddhism and Confucianism. So I became interested in, during those classes with her and a couple of her other colleagues in the history department, in how religious traditions are recreated and interpreted within a range of cultural and political contexts. And that sent me off to the religion department at Swarthmore, which was also a very strong department, and gave me the chance to work there with Don Swearer, whom some of your listeners will probably know through his very important work on Thai Buddhism. And he was a tremendous resource in exposing me to history of Buddhism, especially in South and Southeast Asia. Also to work that was then being done or had recently been done on Buddhism in relation to colonialism, and some of the early work on what we would now call the problems of Buddhism and modernity. I was at Swarthmore by chance, really. I ended up as an undergraduate studying overseas in Sri Lanka for 6 months. And that was clearly a very big catalyst in terms of turning my attention to really centrally to South Asia and Sri Lanka, particularly within a South Asian Buddhist environment. And I was lucky enough to be there for 6 months, as I think I said just a moment ago, with a program called the IELTS program, which is still running. And I was there working under the direction of Professor John Strong, whom some of your listeners will also know, another super scholar of Buddhism. So I was in very good company there with Professor Strong, but also studying Sri Lankan history and economics and about Buddhism in Sri Lanka, anthropology to some extent, with some of the leading lights of the Sri Lankan university sector at that time. And working with them was a tremendous boost to my knowledge of Sri Lanka and my interest in the country. And I think those 6 months of living there really laid the foundation for my ongoing interest in the country and in Buddhism in Sri Lanka. When I returned from that undergraduate stint in Sri Lanka, I ended up doing some thesis research on Sri Lankan Buddhist temple communities in North America, focusing on Washington, D.C. and New York, Queens. And that was possible partly thanks to Steve Piker, who's an anthropologist of Southeast Asia with an interest in Buddhism. And his support and Don Swearer's support allowed me to really deepen my work in those areas and build something, you know, by way of modest independent research in those days. So that's a lot about undergraduate experience, but in my case, I think those undergraduate years were really very, very important. Those teachers and that travel to Sri Lanka and time with contemporary Sri Lankan Buddhist communities in North America as well to really make Sri Lanka and Sri Lankan Buddhists a very live and lively part of my own academic consciousness. Do you want to jump in here, Scott, or shall I say a little bit more immediately about how this then leads to the subsequent work?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay. I mean, in some ways, I think that Locations of Buddhism, the book that we're centrally talking about today, was really the dissertation that I wanted to write in graduate school. But I was wisely, I recognize, advised not to write it then. I say wisely because Frank Reynolds, who was my thesis advisor at the time, remarked that it would not really be such a promising topic for a first major research project, partly because Buddhist studies as a field is quite a conservative field, still is, was certainly then, and it might have been disadvantageous to sort of form oneself as a scholar focused centrally on, roughly speaking, modern materials and modern period. Mm-hmm. But in addition, I've come to recognize that he was also even methodologically astute probably as well, because there's certain things about how 19th century or colonial period problems look that you can't really see, or you can't see afresh without looking at them from a longer, deeper temporal perspective. So it was, I think, very, very useful to the gestation of Locations of Buddhism that it was not a dissertation project, and it got set aside for many years, and the dissertation work that then was developed further in my first monograph looks at 18th century Buddhist learned culture, monastic Buddhist learned culture in Sri Lanka, and some institutional developments in the Buddhist world there, focusing on the 18th century, and looking back also sometimes to 13th century models and materials. So Location of Buddhism, you know, centrally takes up a story about 100 years later than the core story of that first book, Buddhist Learning. And I think having that 18th century perspective and an early or pre-colonial perspective was really invaluable for thinking about the British colonial period in Sri Lanka in a sort of more from a new or differently independent perspective.
So getting into the Locations of Buddhism more specifically, the book is focuses in on one particular character, a very learned monk named Nikodeve Sumangala. So for our listeners' sake, let's go ahead and just introduce this person and tell us a bit about his life and why he's a central figure and why you chose to look at him.
Okay, yeah, great question, Scott. Thanks. I knew going into Locations of Buddhism or the early research for it, I knew that I wanted to find some way of exploring Sri Lanka-based Buddhist activities during the British colonial period. And I wanted to work at least to some degree in monastic contexts because Buddhist monks were an important part of the literati and, in a way, you could say, political activists of that time, but also because I know something about, or thought I knew something about, Buddhist monastic culture on the island after the earlier work that I'd done. So it was an area where I felt some confidence in developing further. I spent a certain amount of time, probably a year on and off, as research goes with teaching, trying to learn more about leading monks in the 19th century in Sri Lanka. By leading monks, I mean monks who were more or less public figures, who had their hands in many pies, and who might have left some kind of a textual record that could be used to work with. And a number of monks caught my eye, and I had the benefit of some interesting writings made by Buddhist monastic scholars in the mid-20th century, giving brief biographies of some of these monks. In any case, Hikidue Sumangala, it became clear after some of this preliminary work, both with secondary sources and in the archives in Sri Lanka, it became clear that he was someone who would make a very a potentially valuable focus because he was active in so many areas that he would illuminate a very broad sphere of activity on the island, but also because there was enough of a paper trail about him that I could really explore him and his activities in more depth. There are other monks who would provide a very interesting way in also, but the materials, their writings and so on, were not quite so readily available. So Hikidue Sumangala was of interest to me because he was such an influential and active figure, engaging Buddhists in Sri Lanka, monks and lay people, Buddhists in other Asian countries, scholars of Buddhism, both from Japan, from Europe, from other parts of Asia, America, and then also certainly engaging with colonial administrators of various stripes.
I know early in the book you sort of you open the book with talking about his birth, of course. Can you just say a bit more about his life and his career that that led to him being a rather important figure during this time?
Yes, yeah, certainly. He was from a family that was reasonably well connected, I guess in our terms we might say he was a sort of at least an upper middle class figure. Members of his family had some roles to play in colonial administration, and it's clear that he was connected to some influential local families in the southern coastal region of Sri Lanka. So he was not a nobody from nowhere, and that undoubtedly helped his rise in the Buddhist Sangha, in the monastic community of Sri Lanka. But obviously this was, as it becomes clear from his writings and his activities, that he was also someone, must have been someone of, you know, very strong intellect and really indomitable energies. But he was born in Sri Lanka in the early part of the 19th century when really, Buddhists in Sri Lanka, and certainly, I think maybe we could say especially in the southern coastal regions, were really grappling with Christian presence on the island, Christian missionary activities. There was a certain restlessness growing among Buddhists on the island about how to respond to the criticisms of Buddhism that were emerging from Christians and Christian missionaries. British colonial control was consolidating on the island, so what it was to be colonized was becoming clearer at that time in the first half of the 19th century. And so Hikidue Sumangala, you know, came of age in those currents. And it's important, I think, also that he was a southerner. The southern Buddhist monastic world has a history of close connections to the Sri Lankan upcountry. But it's also, southerners have been very, very proud of their literary heritage and their intellectual heritage, and often have sort of laid claim to a certain kind of independent traditions of interpretation and scholarly work. And I can't prove this, but it seems to me not unlikely that being a southerner was important to him in terms of, I don't know, taking seriously some sense of intellectual responsibility for the vitality of Buddhist monastic culture of his time.
Right. So some of the broader issues, it seems to me, have to do with the sort of discourse of Sri Lankan Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism, sort of protecting Buddhism. And does this come out in the colonial context? Not just a sort of protecting Buddhism for its own sake, but also defending it so much, so to speak, against the British colonialists as well as Christian missionaries?
Yeah, that's right, Scott. I mean, the British said that they would be hands-off of religion in Sri Lanka, and they were administratively often in certain ways hands-off, kept their hands-off religion, but they were very interested in a whole lot of sort of social and institutional areas that religion very quickly touches. And so even without perhaps wanting to or thinking that they would become so, they became quite deeply involved in certain aspects of Buddhist institutional life. For instance, on the island, they were pulled into discussions about monastic succession to temple properties and things of that kind. Depending on who was the governor at any point in time, they and what was the mood in London at the colonial office there, they were more or less supportive of Christian, or encouraging, I should say, of Christian missionary activities in the island. Some governors really tried to dampen down the Christian missionary presence, and some governors were quite happy to give the missionaries quite a bit of free rein. So it's a complicated picture in that regard. It would be too simple to say that the colonial administration was always Christian and pro-Christian and was resolutely opposed to Buddhism. It would be fair to say that most colonial administrators came from, you know, basically a Christian cultural space, and they didn't know a great deal in many cases about Buddhism and other religious traditions on the island, although some of them had developed strong interests in them over time. But certainly from the perspective of many Buddhists on the island, at least the ones who've left us some kind of literary record through their letters and newspaper traces and so on, there was a sense that Buddhism was under siege. And that probably has something to do with these missionary activities and conversions to Christianity on the island, which had been going on already for a couple of hundred years, because the Portuguese and Dutch had also been present as Christians and proselytizers as well as colonial overlords. But I suspect it has particularly to do, in the Sri Lankan case, with the removal, that's a long story for another day, but the removal of the last king of Kandy, who was the supporter of, you know, his structural position was one of supporting the Buddha Sasana, the world of Buddhism in Sri Lanka. And without a Buddhist king on the throne, I think many Sri Lankan Buddhists who operated in a basically royalist frame of reference were really fearful about the future of Buddhism. There was, you know, no sort of supra-patron anymore on the island, and ways of adjudicating Buddhist disputes and ways of organizing the flow of capital for Buddhist institutions were all in different ways thrown into confusion by the absence of a Buddhist king. So the absence of a Buddhist king and the presence of Christian missionaries and intensifying British administrative control, which at least sometimes had pro-Christian and or anti-Buddhist tones, did combine to create a circumstance in which, I think, as best we can tell from the records we have, many Buddhists in the island felt that their world was insecure.
Right. When you said the British were going to be hands-off, it seems that, you know, prior to the colonial period, of course, there was a Buddhist king. And even if you don't want to take a role in religion, that's a pretty drastic change in terms of how the Sri Lankan Buddhist culture is understood prior to the colonial period.
Absolutely. And it's just, jumping quickly to say that you can imagine, you know, sort of Queen Victoria discovering that she was meant to be the queen of the Buddhists. And, you know, she really didn't know how that game was to be played.
Right.
Even if she or her advisors had any remote interest in playing it, you know, she would have been, I mean, I'm saying this partly to make us both laugh and the audience perhaps also, but it is an interesting sort of line down which to travel, you know.
Right.
There would have been no cultural familiarity on the part of the British, really, with what it was to perform that structural function.
Right, and then, what was Hikudoe's sort of reaction to some of these issues that were going on?
So yeah, he's an interesting character. I think I try to draw out some of these strands in the book. An interesting character because he operated in so many areas roughly simultaneously, and so some of what he did was certainly participate in Buddhist Christian debates in writing and verbally. Trying to defend Buddhist positions, doctrines, ways of interpreting certain things textually against missionary attacks. And he had a fair amount of work to do. He didn't do it alone. He had a fair amount of work to do at that time because the Christian missionaries were attacking Buddhism with more and more, we could say, textual sophistication at that point. And they were taking upon themselves to learn quite a bit about teachings contained in the Pali Canon, we might say, or the Buddhist Tipitaka, the authoritative teachings of the Buddhist tradition. And some of these missionaries were learning Pali, you know, a liturgical doctrinal language of Buddhism in Sri Lanka and elsewhere in the region. And they were becoming better and better educated in Buddhist textual matters, which meant that they would come to Buddhists, intellectuals and activists and practitioners with, you know, sort of chapter and verse queries and condemnations of Buddhist positions. So monks like Kekadue Sumangala, who had been trained well in the texts, were extremely valuable in this Buddhist-Christian debate culture because you needed people who knew the texts to argue with these Christians who had started knowing Buddhist texts. So that was one sphere in which he definitely worked, and he did not work alone, as I say. He had a lot of collaborative colleagues, both lay and monastic, in the Buddhist world at his time. Interestingly, some of those collaborations extended across what we might call national or political borders. You know, there's evidence of communication with Buddhist monks in Burma, for instance, where Hikudoe Sumangala or some other monk from Sri Lanka would write and say, you know, hey, we have this conundrum put to us by the missionaries about something to do with, like, flat earth, round earth, that kind of thing, and what are we going to do about it? And, you know, tell me how you've been answering that question with, you know, when it's posed to you. But Hikudoe Sumangala was also very much involved in activities that we might think of as operating somewhat outside the sphere of Christian threat or British colonial threat. And that's one of the things that I do try to draw out in the book, is that not all of what he did was a response to British presence, or at least not a direct response to British presence, and not all of it was a response to Christianity. He was very involved in caste debates. Sri Lanka is a country that has a long history of organization along caste lines, and there were very interesting, you might say, caste politics that characterized the 19th century, and he was active in those arguments. And that's something we sometimes find counterintuitive. What's a Buddhist monk doing writing about caste? But in fact, that was a big part of what he did as an intellectual, and it was not seen as by him as something contrary to other obligations, you might say, intellectual responsibilities that he had, that he undertook. Another big problem or challenge, I guess, for him and some of the other monks of his day was how to engage with two new forms of Buddhist interest that were characteristic of the time. One of them was the European and American scholarly interest in Buddhism. You know, these scholars of Buddhism kept washing up on Sri Lanka's shores from places like Moscow and London, and or sending letters, and they wanted to know certain things about Buddhist texts, and they wanted sometimes copies of texts, and they wanted to meet famous scholar monks and so on. And you know, these people occupied a certain amount of social time and also intellectual time for monks like Hikudoe Sumangala. They had really obligations to these people that they often tried to meet very faithfully, I think quite generously, one gets the sense from the letters. But sometimes the questions that these scholars were asking were questions that would have seemed puzzling to the Sri Lankan monks, or the Sri Lankan monks would become frustrated that the answers they gave were not really properly assimilated by the scholars of Buddhism abroad. So it's another interesting dimension of this time, a somewhat fraught and shifting relationship between monk scholars and non-monk Euro-American scholars of Buddhism during this time. And Judith Snodgrass has written some things about this, which are useful to see also, I think. So those were all pieces of the puzzle for Hikkaduri Sumangala. What I was about to say is that in addition to the foreign scholars of Buddhism creating another sphere of obligation and responsibility, this was a time in which new forms of lay Buddhist, non-monastic Buddhist associations were forming, partly probably as a kind of on the model of Christian church associations. So, you know, one of the features of some Protestant traditions is, you know, the kind of congregational ways in which a congregation, the non-clerical congregation, organizes for certain kinds of good works and so on. And that began to be the case in the Buddhist world in Sri Lanka. And a variety of small and larger lay Buddhist associations were developing on the island in the later part of the 19th century. Some of them lasted very, very short periods of time. Kind of in the blink of an eye, they were done. Others had long, long histories, including the Buddhist Theosophical Society and the Mahabodhi Society, two societies that I look at a bit in the book. And these societies are kind of interesting case. They are often described by scholars as examples of the laicization of Buddhism in the period. I think that's incorrect. The lay leaders of these societies were very, very keen to have monastic involvement. And in certain cases, we can see that monks like Hikkaduri Sumangala played a very big role in helping to mobilize the activities of the societies, in doing some of the intellectual work of the societies, in managing complicated social relations, and so on. So these were new forms of lay monastic engagement, I think we should say. And they took a lot of time also for someone like Hikkaduri Sumangala. So that gives some sense, perhaps, for your listeners. You've already read the book, you know these things, Scott, but for your listeners, maybe give some sense of some of the spheres of activity that Hikkaduri Sumangala and some of the other leading monks of his time were involved with.
Right, and you describe it toward the end of the book as locative pluralism or collectivities of belonging, if I remember correctly, which I think is sort of a really interesting theoretical turn to make as a way of exploring historical figures. If you could sort of say a bit more about what those terms might mean in terms of how we can understand Buddhist history, particularly through individuals.
Sure. Thank you for that question, Scott. It is something that I think is potentially useful in the book. At least it's a problem I was trying to puzzle through for myself in writing the book. I think that this phrase that I introduce at certain points, locative pluralism, and then I also mentioned, as you say, collectivities of belonging, those are both, on my part, basically reactions to identity, which I think has been doing too much work too badly in studies of Buddhism in Sri Lanka, historical and contemporary, but also I think it's problematic historically more widely, and I'm not the only person to be thinking along these lines. There's a very interesting set of essays by Frederick Cooper, who's a historian of Africa, which takes up some of these questions as well. You know, what does a term like identity really do for us, and does it do enough? Is it too broad or sloppy a term? With respect to Sri Lanka, particularly, one of the problems that I think we face now in scholarly circles is that even serious scholars think that there's something called a Sinhala Buddhist identity. Mm-hmm. It's not really clear what this means. That is to say, it's a little bit clear what it means in contemporary political discourse, and you could either be happy or not happy about some of the values that are ascribed to a so-called Sinhala Buddhist identity in contemporary political discourse. But leaving that aside, if we try to move back in historical time, that term, Sinhala Buddhist identity, has this contemporary set of meanings associated with it, which don't map out very well at all onto the historical evidence of the past. So in my view, it's anachronistic to apply the term, the contemporary term, Sinhala Buddhist identity, to a period even, say, before 1956. So that's one problem. Secondarily, identity singular seems to me problematic because we should know even from our own experience as people living in the world that we are many things to many people, to put it in sort of fairly simple ways. And the term identity worries me in historical work because it it seems to me to occlude so much from view. It either asks us to think about things at such a level of generality that it's not very helpful, or it suggests that there really is one point of identification for a person or a group at all times, which we should know from our own experience is not true. So with this notion of locative pluralism and an explicit attempt to explore different spheres of activity simultaneously in which there could be different collectivities of belonging to which Hikidue Sumangala felt that he had a responsibility, I'm really engaging in a sort of historical thought experiment here and a methodological one, trying to find some way of telling an historical story without getting caught in this singular identity term, which is anachronistic but also inadequate to the evidence at hand.
Right, because he's moving from one area to another pretty seamlessly, doing this sort of lay monastic engagement and as well as Buddhist Christian dialogue, as well as, you know, more what we might think of as sort of traditional, to use a horrible word, monastic duties. So it's I think it's a very and as you say, it's very helpful to think about our own experiences that we are more than one thing to more different people. Which to think of certain identities, I think this gets to the other issue that I think is very important in your book, and that has to do with the way that we have framed colonial Buddhism or Protestant Buddhism or Buddhist modernity. There's all these terms that have been used in the last 20 or 30 years to describe the changes that happened in Buddhism in colonial contexts. And I think that your book makes a very important contribution to these issues. So to sort of begin this part of the conversation, to sort of frame what we mean, what previous scholars have meant by these terms of Protestant Buddhism, and how you see these terms used and how you react to them in your book, I think is the question I'm driving at here.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for raising this as well. It's helpful, I think, to have you raise this one. This term Protestant Buddhism is an important term, and it was, I think, a very valuable term in the way that it was first introduced. And it's important to remember, and I try to indicate this in the book too, that it's a term that was coined by Gannath Obeysekara, a very talented anthropologist of Sri Lanka, many years ago. Well, not so many, some decades ago. To do sort of very restricted work for him in an analysis of the Anagarika Dharmapala, a certain kind of quasi-monastic, quasi-lay Buddhist activist, late 19th, early 20th century Sri Lanka. And Obeysekara developed this term, Protestant Buddhism, to discuss some of the activities of Dharmapala, and he expanded a little bit further to suggest that maybe this Protestant Buddhist term was useful to think about some of the Buddhist dynamics in the colonial period, because Buddhists were sometimes taking on more Protestantized forms of organization at the same time that they were protesting against Christianity. But it was a very creative formulation in his initial usage, but it wasn't intended to become the descriptor for all of Sri Lankan Buddhism for 150 years, from 1815 when the British take Sri Lanka to now when we have whatever we're now calling modern Buddhism. And it wasn't even really intended, I think, to, you know, be the key to a discussion of British colonial period Buddhism. So it was an analytical try and a really valuable one, but it had a more restricted agenda. I think that that's important to say because I'm not dissing his term. And I think that his work is very, very important. What came after was that a process through which scholars progressively expanded the reach of the term, and they began to use it as a term of convenience. so that it came to be the stand, kind of the analytical category that was the go-to category when people wanted to explain Buddhism in the 19th century. Oh, yes, well, that's when Protestant Buddhism comes around in the island, or that's when Buddhism in Sri Lanka becomes Protestantized, or something like that.
And it seems, so like, it's been applied yeah. even to non-Sri Lankan contexts as well.
Yeah, it has. Absolutely. Yeah.
To me, it's part of the difficulty.
That would be very, very interesting to see. You've seen that it's been explored in Thai context. You've seen it in East Asian context. People think, well, does it tell us anything we need to know about even, you know, Euro-American Buddhism and so on? So, it's an important point to make, Scott. It's taken on a life of its own, even beyond Sri Lanka and beyond Southern Asia, we could say. In this wider use of the term, I don't have all the pages of the book in front of me here, owing to a combination of technical difficulties, but some of the key features of it in its wider usage include what's often called increased rationalization, increased indebtedness to textual authority on a kind of so-called biblical model, a lessening of the investment of Buddhists in ritual activities, and the rise of lay religious authority over in place of monastic authority. And the evidence I've seen from 19th century Sri Lanka suggests that most of that is that really that's all wrong. I mean, to put it so strongly as it's put in the strongest versions of the Protestant Buddhism description is extremely misleading. And one of the things that I'm particularly keen to show in the book is that Buddhists are still really keen on ritual. Monks have still a lot of power, and the hermeneutical techniques, if you want to call them that, for dealing with Buddhist scriptural materials or authoritative textual materials have a very long history, and they're not somehow recalibrated on a Protestant model in the 19th century. People like Hikkaduwe Sumangala are reading old books about how you read Pali texts, and they're quite conscious of that, also Sanskrit and Sinhala. So in its larger use, when its use was expanded beyond the initial formulation by Gannath Obeyesekara, the term Protestant Buddhism is, I think, misleading because, it's been used as the key descriptor for a very, very large and complicated historical field. Lots of people, lots of years, lots of social phenomena fall under that category as it's been used lately. But also, it's wrong. Empirically, it's inadequate.
It seems to suggest that there was a switch that's thrown almost, that at some point there was, you know, this one form of Buddhism and then the colonialist came and everything changed.
That's right.
And it seems as though, particularly what you show in the book, is that there was a lot of continuity between pre-colonial Buddhist culture in Sri Lanka and post-colonial that I think supports your claim that this term is incorrect when it's applied so broadly.
Your term throwing the switch is a great one, I think. And this is where, you know, we can't just say that the Protestant Buddhism term is wrong or inadequate. Historians, you know, lots of us, not just me, have to go into the archives and into the evidence that we have and really try to come up with something that's more satisfying. Because if we just sit around and say, well, that term is no good, then that's really just sloppy. So, and my book is not at all exhausted in this regard. No, I don't think that somebody, you know, threw a switch in, in 1860 or 1875 or whichever, you know, year you want to choose, and all of a sudden we have Protestant Buddhism. The story of how Buddhists are reinventing Buddhism is a very, very interesting story for any time or any place, if you like that kind of story. And there's a lot for us to learn about Sri Lanka in the 19th century still, as well as every other period. We're a tiny field and we know far too little. So there's a lot of work to be done, and in case any aspiring graduate students are listening to this podcast, I want to say there's great material in the archives. And if people are willing to learn languages like Pali and Sinhala especially, there's a lot to be done. One of the difficulties with working in the colonial period is the linguistic challenges, and we need more people who will read more things in Sinhala and Pali and Sanskrit, because a lot of the really nuanced intellectual work, social criticism, evidence of shifting social engagements is not in English. And that shouldn't surprise us, really, but it often seems to. So if we want to do better, then what I think is the inadequate formulation of Protestant Buddhism in its you know extensive formulation. If we want to do better than that, then we need more people with more skill to read more stuff, so that we can begin to deepen you know our understanding of what was really going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that. To continue on with this topic, it seems as though Protestant Buddhism has been in some ways almost replaced in the last the last decade or two with the term modern Buddhism or Buddhist modernity.
Right.
Many of the characterizations of Buddhist modernism, I think, mirror some of the broad formulations of Protestant Buddhism. So from that point of view, I mean, the subtitle of your book, of course, is Colonialism and Modernity. And so, how does modernity fit into this particular story and this particular monk?
Right. Yeah. Thank you for that too, Scott. It is interesting what you observe. I think you are right that in the most recent years. At least five, maybe, a bit more than that, Buddhist modernism or modern Buddhism have become keywords, in a sense, for the field. And Protestant Buddhism has slipped a bit to the back. I think that partly people began to realize, you know, I was not the first person to criticize the term Protestant Buddhism by a long shot. People began to realize that there was something inadequate about it. But it's nonetheless, it sort of spoke to a set of puzzles that people have had difficulty putting down. And so while thinking maybe that's not quite the right term anymore, they've remained engaged with some of these puzzles. And puzzles to do with, I think there's maybe a kind of scholarly instinct that somehow colonialism must have been made a really big difference if we could just figure out what it was. But also, as studies of modernism and modernity have exploded in fields outside Buddhist studies for much more than 5 years, it's natural that the reverberations of that have found their way into Buddhist studies. And so I think, in some ways, what we see is that a newer generation of scholars is now working with the problem of Buddhism and modernity because it's the newer problem. And the old problem of Buddhism and colonialism is the old problem. In many ways, they're sometimes set up to be the same problem, but under different names, and then sometimes not. It really depends on what understanding of the modern or modernity or modernism any particular scholar is working with. And one of the things that I do in the book is make some pleas, I think, although it's not my central concern, I do make some pleas at certain points that we need to be much more precise about what we really mean when we talk about a modern or modernity, because any analysis of so-called Buddhism and so-called modernity is really only worth, you know, it's only as good as the precision of those analytical terms, right? And Buddhism is too big for most purposes, and modernity is also, in my view, usually too big. At the very least, someone needs to really specify, you know, what are they invoking when they say the modern or modernism and so on. So we need a lot more work, I think, along these lines, just trying to make much more claims that are more precise and decide when it's really going to be valuable to use that kind of analytical language and when is it not. So just as Protestant Buddhism became sloppily used in some quarters, modern Buddhism, Buddhist modernity, all that stuff is sometimes sloppily used, and it's sometimes well used too. You know, there are good books written trying to understand the genealogy of the term and what it means where and so on. That's really valuable. One of the things that was interesting to me about Hikkaduwe Sumangala is that he didn't seem to think what I say in the book is that he didn't, the evidence of his that I have anyway does not show a sense of being in a new time, like so different from another time that we might think that this is now the modern and the other time was something else. Mm. And he doesn't participate, at least in the extant materials that I've seen, he doesn't participate in a kind of temporal developmental discourse or like call for a new Buddhism, for a new age. Mm. You know, and some Buddhist monks in Sri Lanka a little bit later do that, and some Buddhist monks and lay people too in Sri Lanka, and Buddhist monks and lay people in other Buddhist countries obviously have done that at different points in time. If we were to really, I think, improve the scholarly conversation on Buddhism and modernity, one of the things we could do is really look to see who in the Buddhist world invokes this idea of a new time, when, how, why.
Because mm-hmm. it also, you know,
seems... And that would...
Go ahead.
Yeah, please go ahead.
It seems to me that one of the sloppy ways that we use these terms is to, going back to your idea of collectivities of belonging and whatnot, that we will label people or identify people as being mm-hmm. modernists or traditionalists. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in some ways these folks might be more modern or might be more traditional, but in mm-hmm. other ways they're different. So, you know, I think this is, it's very compelling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a lot of food for thought here, and one of the books that's been very, very thought-provoking for me is Anne Hansen's book, How to Behave, about so-called modernist monks in Cambodia. And one of the interesting things that her work, caused me to reflect on more self-consciously is this point, you know, when do Buddhist intellectuals say that they're modern or they live in a new age or they're creating Buddhism for a new age? And that's a point that she asks and explores in her book. And there's a companion question, I think, which goes beyond the reach of her book, but which is worth asking, which is, and what do they say when they're not saying that? Mm. You know, and that goes back partly to my collectivities of belonging, because it's also entirely possible, and by this I do not mean duplicity in speech or intent, but it's perfectly possible for people, you know, intellectuals, for instance, to be expressing, an interpretation that really talks about like new Buddhism for a new age in one context because they think that that's a valuable framework of understanding or a call to arms or whatever it is in a certain elocutionary moment. But in some other context, they may put it a different way. So one of the things that I think we don't really understand, for instance, or at least I don't understand, maybe I'm just, you know, still failing to understand it, is, you know, how are Buddhist intellectuals what I really want to say here, let me take a step back and say, I think we need much more intellectual history within Buddhist studies, in South and Southeast Asian Buddhist studies anyway. There's more of it on the East Asian side. But, you know, these lay and monastic intellectuals, they thought complicated thoughts and expressed them to a lot of people in a lot of different contexts. And we have not, for the most part, really engaged that world of intellectual output, much less than our colleagues in East Asian studies have done work in intellectual history. Which means that we don't really understand the intellectual world, or if you want to stay away from the term intellectual and go for something a bit broader, we don't really understand the discursive world, you know, that we are describing sometimes as modern or modernist. Mm-hmm. We don't even know the content of this world, and yet we're rushing to apply these categories to it. It's utter nonsense.
Right, and you know, and it reminds me of another a passage in your book, because you know, we began this conversation talking about colonialism, and clearly colonialism has a huge impact on this part of the world. And I'm gonna quote your book here and say that you say quote, "We can choose to examine spheres of intellectual and social activity in a historical context emphatically marked by the presence of colonial rule instead of looking at intellectual and social responses to colonialism." That was one of those passages that I read and thought that's exactly right on. to sort of talk about, rather than seeing the intellectual life of these folks as nothing but a response to one particular mm-hmm. issue, mm-hmm. but not forgetting that this is an important part mm-hmm. of their mm-hmm. their culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for noting that passage. It was an attempt to try to bring some things to the fore for our reflection. It seems to me, you know, very arrogant, basically. basically arrogant from a kind of external perspective to assume that quote-unquote colonialism managed to dominate the lifescapes and the thoughtscapes of all these people for all this time. It just, you know, it seems unreasonable. But also, since colonialism is another one of these words that, you know, sometimes doesn't do quite enough for us, it also doesn't tell us very much, right? If we say that such and such is a reaction to colonialism, well, then we need a lot more precision again. So there's just a lot of, I think, problems, both analytical and empirical problems for us to think through.
So think about these big terms, colonialism and modernity and Protestant Buddhism. It seemed in reading the book very clear that what you were really trying to do was to take it back down to a small scale by focusing in on just one particular person rather than the broad sweep of these big general terms in order to get to some precision. Am I reading that correctly?
Well, in some ways, yes. I think that, but we might want to separate out the issues a little bit more. There are certain problems with the terms themselves, or maybe better said, maybe more generously said, we need to think about the reach of the terms, what they can do for us, where and where they falter. And there we need to choose our analytical vocabulary in relation to our aims. And I think we need to choose our analytical vocabulary and our comparative organizing terms more carefully, maybe more creatively than we have sometimes done. And we may want to move away from some of these terms which have become so commonplace, but they're also really big and unwieldy. So that's one part of it, one part of my, I guess, the direction in which I'm moving. But the question about scale is related but also partly separate. That is to say, if we operate from a smaller scale of research, focusing on an individual and his projects and networks, as I do in this book, or, I don't know, history of a society and its interconnections or something like that, something that is, roughly speaking, maybe micro-historical in orientation, we're going to see certain things about the processes at work and cause and effect patterns and things like that from that vantage point that we might not, that we wouldn't see from a larger scale of generality. So if I'm studying plantation economy, I'm going to see something different than if I study the organization of a particular plantation. And if I study Buddhist monasticism or Buddhism, I'm going to see something different from what I will see if I study Hikkaduwe Sumangala. You know, I'm looking in different places and I'm seeing things on different level of specificity. I think that to bring the two pieces together, I think that doing some of these smaller scale studies along the lines of the Hikkaduwe Sumangala project might help us to reconfigure some of our analytical terms or give us some food for thought about developing new ones. So if we see what happens in the world of Hikkaduwe Sumangala, and we need to develop some analytical tools that can encompass that and speak to those that empirical record. So my locative pluralism and collectivities of belonging are two attempts to introduce terms that I think of as analytical terms, but they're responding to the archive. And I'm not saying those terms are exhaustive. There are other terms waiting to be conceived of, and those, you know, will need to be refined or whatnot. So I'm not sure if that's been clear enough, Scott, because I'm thinking on my feet in response to your good question. But I think we want to think about scale of research. Where are we looking in the historical record? At what register? Or what on what scale? But then also in terms of your question about the analytical terms, what does looking at smaller scale, at the smaller scale empirically, teach us about the need to refine or refine existing analytical terms or invent new ones?
Right. Depending on where we look, we might see the strengths or weaknesses of pre-existing analytical terms or the need to explore new horizons for
yeah, that's, Yeah, that's right. I think that's correct. And there's just, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, and it should be really tempting for us. It shouldn't be off-putting. It should be a great invitation.
Absolutely. You know, I think we're nearing the end of our time, and I want to say again that I think this is a wonderful contribution to many fields, really, or subfields within Buddhist studies proper. The traditional last question that we ask on our show, of course, is to see what you're currently working on and what we can expect from you in the future.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's been a fun conversation for me, and it's interesting to bring my mind back to that book project and have a chance to discuss it with you. Your questions have been really thought-provoking. In terms of new work, I'm going back in time and looking right now at Lankan or Sri Lankan mainland Southeast Asian Buddhist ties between about 1000 and 1500. And it's a very, very tricky period to work on. The evidence is meager and so on. But I should say, to probably just something more here to explain, I'm interested in it from two perspectives, namely, what can we say about the connections that did obtain among these places during this period in the sphere, particularly of monastic culture. I'm thinking about connections between various Lankan or Sri Lankan kingdoms, Sukhothai, Ayutthaya, Lanna, Pegu or Bago in Burma, Bagan early on, Inua a bit later, and so on. So I'm interested in what's now, roughly speaking, Sri Lanka, Burma, and Thailand between 1000 and 1500, and what we could say better than we have said so far about the connections that obtained in monastic culture among these places. But I'm also interested, the second piece is that I'm interested in how Sri Lanka or Lanka is represented in texts composed in mainland Southeast Asia that are reporting about this time. Hmm. So there's there are many different kinds of, roughly speaking, chronicle texts that were composed in the second millennium on the mainland that in different ways take up the image of Lanka or the problem of Lanka or the promise of Lanka more often. So that's another piece of this puzzle that I'm looking at. So how is Lanka represented and textualized from the Southeast Asian mainland in relation to Buddhist monastic culture in this time, roughly 1000 to 1500? And what can we say more than we have found so far about the actual empirical connections that existed among these locations? And much of the work will be very collaborative, is already very collaborative, because it involves a lot of resources that I don't have solo command over linguistically and so on. So it should be a fun project extending for quite some time. I don't think that I will be able to give anything like the final answer on this very, very complicated story, but I'm hoping to explore this somewhat and be able to develop, in some ways, maybe able to present some new evidence and some new ways of thinking about evidence that we already have. And in some other cases, hope to ask at least a few questions that might open up you know, future work, collaborative work, or work that others are doing independently. So it's a new field. I often say that I'm going back to grad school again.
It sounds totally fun. to be honest.
It should keep me feeling lively for a while.
Great. Thank you again so much for being on the show.
All right. Thanks again, Scott. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks a lot. You've been listening to an interview with Anne Blackburn, author of Locations of Buddhism, Colonialism, and Modernity in Sri Lanka, here on the New Books in Buddhist Studies channel of the New Books Network. Thanks for listening.